Okay.
I'm fine.
Okay.
It is good.
All right. Thank you again, Rabbi Michalowicz. Really appreciate it. As the rabbi was just mentioning, this week's parsha starts off with the concept of Eilish Shmos B'nai Yisrael Habayim Mitzrayim. When the Jewish people came down to Mitzrayim, they came down as households. Eis Yaakov Ishu Beiso. Rav Hirsch, Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, writes in his introduction to the Haggadah also, he says, when the Jewish people came time to leave Egypt, how were we congregated? We had a great leader, Moshe. So you imagine we're sitting in a stadium someplace in Egypt. He says, but no, people were congregated where? We know how the setup looked. Where were people sitting? They were sitting also in their homes, around the Pesach Seder. When the final redemption comes, the Jewish people went down to Egypt as family units, as a mishpacha, families, Eis Yaakov Ishu Beiso, families. And when it came time for redemption, they survived during the exile as families, and then time for redemption came, they were also sitting as families. When the future redemption will come, the Jewish people will also be sitting as families. And Rav Hirsch writes the following thing. He writes, to inherit a home, to build a home, this encompasses a Jew's entire happiness and ethical vocation on earth. And in truth, is it not also the foundation of all human welfare? If only this first page of the founding charter of God's nation, he's writing the Haggadah over here, were read in the conference halls and the palaces where the fates and fortunes of nations are deliberated. If only this great Magna Carta were consulted wherever educational and culture, peace and salvation of men and mankind are discussed. For the fate of men, their success or failure, is decided neither in the chambers of rulers nor on the battlefield. It is not decided in business concerns, in colleges and institutions of arts and sciences, or in houses of worship. It is sealed only in one place, in the parental home. Conceive children in purity. See to it that every child, whether he is born in a palace or a hut, is welcomed and nurtured by the love of a mother and a father who have preserved their purity for parenthood. Endeavor to facilitate and strengthen the establishment of sanctified homes. Then the foundation for the welfare of the people will have been laid, and the nation will be assured from the start that all its affairs at every level will be dealt by men of pure hearts and undefiled hands. If one wishes the spirit of ethical integrity to permeate his society, then there is no other way than to build houses. There exists no substitute for the home. And if one is looking elsewhere for the source of peace and prosperity, he is searching in vain. All of a nation's politics and diplomacy, its theories of national economy and institutions for mass education, its trade, its industries, its schools, and its community centers, none of these will save the people from extinction if they let the parental home become a parody. Are children born for the sake of the state's false concern, Rav Hirsch writes, in the middle 1800s, instead of the warm love of parents? Does the census show ever-growing numbers of children without parents and parents without children? Does the nation's high society make a mockery of morality and modesty? If so, then all the palaces it is building are founded on quicksand. Rav Hirsch is writing 150 years ago. He saw the introduction to, and he saw around the corner what the world that we're going to look like, what it's going to look like around the corner. So here we have this important declaration, and it's an understanding that we carry with us from generation to generation how important it is and how necessary it is for the Jewish people to have a home. And one of the questions that I wake up to when I read this is, if this is such an important thing, it's such an important value to have a home, to build a home, as Rav Hirsch says, it's the foundation of the Jewish nation, it's the foundation of the whole world. So we have schools where people go to become doctors. We have schools where people go to become lawyers. We have schools where people go to become specialists in all kinds of different areas of life for everything that you could possibly imagine, to become psychiatrists and psychologists, for everything. If people want to become engineers, they go to school for many years. So if it's such an important thing, so why don't we have a parenting school? Where's the parenting school where people learn how to become qualified? Where's the licensing that people that should be needed, that people in order before we step up to the role become parents? So where is the school? That's the question that I had in my brain. And I think that the answer is that there is a school that we go to, that every one of us went to. We went to a school of parenting, and we went there not for 1 year or 2 years. We went there for also 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 20, 23 years. We went there for a number of years. And which school is that everybody goes to? And that is called the home that we ourselves grew up in. And I think that that's really the jump start and the basis for this discussion. This is what launched me on this project, because the truth is, you know, my qualification for speaking about it is not something that I learned necessarily from the Talmud or any other place. It's because I'm in the trenches, you know, we're in the trenches, you know. The Talmud says, "Ein chacham kabal hanasoyim." There's no wise person, like somebody who's been through it. I got the scars to show. You know, this is, you know, this is my diploma here. Okay, I'm going to hide it right now. Okay. Yeah. So the premise of tonight's discussion is we all went to a school, but the truth is, when we look back at the school, many of us will realize that there are nice, wonderful things that we heard and we received from our parents, and that we would like to carry on, but there's other things we'd like to filter out and not necessarily pass down. Maybe certain language or certain approach or a certain style that we would prefer that wouldn't be the automatic. But what happens is, the natural tendency is, if a person was in, anybody who knows anything about these type of social services areas knows that if unfortunately somebody was punched or beaten or abused, so even though they didn't like the way it felt, but that was the language that they learned, and they will tend to be abusers themselves. You know, I'm not talking about necessarily even terrible, destructive abuse, but any type of verbal abuse, because that's how the person learned to say I love you. That's how they learn to talk. And therefore, there's a necessity nowadays more than ever for sort of like a retraining and a putting new treads and thinking through the principles of parenting, whereas before it might have come through more healthier means that people learned in a healthy environment and passed on healthy ideas. Now there's been so much disrupt and so much lost along the way that we're all sort of winging it, and that's what inspired me to go back and to recreate what I call now, and this is really, we'll speak about just the first half of what I call the Ten Commandments of Parenting. What's the Ten Commandments of Parenting? Not just a random list of ten. I'm going to try to go according to the actual Ten Commandments themselves. And based upon those Ten Commandments, we know that one side of the Ten Commandments is commandments between man and God, and the other side is mitzvahs between man and man. And similarly, mitzvahs between man and God, it's really ain't nobody's business but my own. That's the private realm. And the mitzvahs between man and man are interactive. That's more the public realm. In a certain sense, when you look at a tree, so everybody loves to admire beautiful fruits that come at the edge of the trees. You know, oranges in the springtime in Florida. Wow, we can't imagine, you know, how beautiful. But most of that work is being done underground in the wintertime when nobody sees it. So there's a whole hidden world, there's a submerged world that gives birth to the fruits that come up later on the edge of the trees. Therefore, the side between man and God is really, we're going to define it and we're going to work with it, working through the Ten Commandments, is really talking about the relationship between and within the parents themselves. And the second part, which I don't think we're going to have time to get to tonight, right? We'll save it for some other time, is really the interactive part between the parents and the children themselves, because that's more mitzvahs bein adam l'chaveru. So that's the structure of tonight's talk. We're going to go into the roots. If there's no roots, then there ain't no fruits. So there's a lot of root work that has to be done, and the principles of root work, I would like to say, we can find in the Ten Commandments themselves. So let's jump in. So the first, people don't know the Ten Commandments. I'm not going to work with the assumption that people know what the Ten Commandments are. Right? Somebody once said, if everybody would know the Ten Commandments, there'll be no 11 o'clock news. Okay? But unfortunately, I sat with a group of students recently, you know, and I asked them, Jewish students, you know, and amongst, as a committee, they couldn't come up with 6 out of 10. They couldn't come up with 6 out of 10. And I was surprised. You know, good Jewish kids that even came to learn Jewish subjects, but they didn't know. So the first of the Ten Commandments goes like this. It says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. The Almighty introduces Himself to the Jewish nation. Right? These are the first words that are spoken to the entire Jewish nation. 600,000 adult males between the age of 20 and 60. Perhaps 3.5 million people in total. Standing in front of the Almighty, and the Almighty, He has just taken the Jewish people out of Egypt, and He says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha. This is the great declaration. Asher Hoseisichem Eretz Mitzrayim. And I took you out of Egypt. If you listen to the words over here, this is really the first introduction of parenting. The first introduction of parenting, the parents declare to the children, and they say, this is who we are, and this is what we do. Anochi Hashem Elokecha, the Almighty says, this is who I am, right? I am Hashem, and this is what I do, and I took you out of Egypt. And every parent also declares to his children the same thing. He says, this is who we are, and this is what we do. And that's the first thing that the children are watching. Someone once said the parents were lecturing the kids, and we all know this, you know, that where the parent gives the lecture, says, don't do as I do, do as I say. And we know that that doesn't work, because the kid looks back and says, what you're doing is so loud, I can't hear what you're saying. You know? And we really find that also in the first chapter of the Shema, where we say, V'hayu ha-devrim ha'ele asher nochi mitzav ha-yom alav avecha. And these words which I commit you, they should put them on your heart. And then it says, V'shinantam levenecha v'dibarta bam, and then you should speak in them, and you should teach them to your children. So it says the first requirement is you put them onto the heart. Why? Because children read the heart. They know when you mean it, and they know when you don't mean it. You know, it says, Philip, we don't talk like that. And the kid says, in front of company. You know. they have their own little editing system that's going on. Yeah? I remember I once heard, it was a speaker, he came, and he asked the young lady in the front, he says, what's your parents' greatest source of pleasure in this world? A big smile came across this young lady, she goes, me. Yeah. And she says, what's your parents' greatest source of pain? She says, my sister. And kids have that ability to create within us great pleasure. You know, did you see what he did? Did you see how, you know? And also great pain. Did you see what he did? Did you? And why? Because it's like we're watching ourselves and what we really believe. We're watching our whole insides being projected onto a screen. So we see the kid misbehaving and you get a call from the principal. It's the most embarrassing thing. It's very much like, and we say in the second paragraph of Shema also, just to say in the second paragraph, it says, you teach your children, to speak in them. How? The way that you lie down, and the way that you go on your way, and the way you go about your business, is the biggest educational process that teaches the children how you should speak in them and how you should go about. Whatever we do, the children imitate. It's like the parent... gets a call from the principal, the principal calls up and says, Mr. Berkowitz, if your name is Berkowitz, I don't need to see you, I'm just choosing an example, you know. I see the Berkowitz has just left. Come on, we'll talk about the Schwartz. Oh, the Schwartz has just left. Oh my God, the room is empty out. Hey, give me another name. Okay. So let's say, for example, you know, the Berkowitz is, you know, so says, Mr. Berkowitz, he says, we gotta come down and you gotta speak about your kid. He says, what happened? What do you do? I have to come to the office and speak about it. And the father says, no, you have to tell me. What do you do? He says, well, we have a couple of reports that your kid is stealing pencils from the other kids in school. And the father says, why should my kid steal pencils from the other kids in school? I bring home all the pencils he needs from the office. It's unbelievable. The father comes home with pencils, you know, from the office and office supplies, you know, yellow pads and this and that, you know. And he says, okay, we don't have to go out to the store and get school supplies. We have plenty of school supplies. The kid understands. You go with empty suitcases, you come back with full suitcases, you know, with things that you've gotten with from other people, that you stole from other people. So the father thinks he's, you know, obviating the need for school supplies, and the kid says, that's what you do. That's what Abba does. I remember when I was teaching in Hebrew day school, it was a frightening thing. There was one kid who came into the school. He was such a sweet kid, such a little bubble of faces. So sweet. And he came from the school that I was in. Was like kids that the parents didn't want to send them to public school. So it wasn't really, you know, they weren't really motivated to be there as real yeshiva students. But the parents didn't want them in public. So it was a default type of a situation. And this kid Avi came in. He came in from one of the regular yeshivas in Muncie. And I was wondering, like, why he came in. You know, it's not my job to wonder why. You know, so listen, I got to deal with the kids, and I got to deal with him, and it's not my job to ever to look in that little manila envelope, that permanent record card. You know, that I didn't want to, you know. But they remember the permanent record cards? You always get this. It's going to go into your permanent record card. You know? I believe in the ultimate permanent record card, but I don't know. I still don't believe, you know, unless there's an FBI file on me that there's really a permanent record. There's anything in there. They open up, there's nothing there, you know. But I don't, it's not my job to look in the files. You know, I got to deal with the kid, this and that. So I never asked why he's there, but he looked like such a sweet, innocent kid. He was a sweet, beautiful kid. But it didn't take a couple of days before already I started getting complaints to the other kid. I said, you know, Avi is grizzing me, and Avi is doing this to me, and Avi is stalking me, and Avi is poking me, and Avi is scratching me, and Avi zetsed me, and Avi, you know, all the different, you know, verbs over there. And Avi's doing this. And I said, you know, listen, leave Avi alone. You know, I said, Avi, he said, no, I didn't do anything. See, he didn't do anything. Sort of innocent face, you know, little Charlie Brown face, like, you know, I didn't do anything. You know, and I said, they're picking on him. It's xenophobia. The kid came in the middle of the year, and they don't want to let him break into their circle, and they're sort of excluding him. So one day he was absent, and they said, he really? I said, no. I said, listen, I gave him such a lecture. You know, listen, you got to let him into the circle, and you got to let him feel good, and you got to open up warm, and you know, and let him in. Stop trying to exclude Avi. Stop picking on Avi. But don't give me the button. You know, and I really let him have it. And then, but the complaint continues. One day, I'm looking out, the hallway was dark, and I'm looking out through that 9.5 by 11 inch window that goes out into the hallway. It's an old teacher's trick, okay? And I'm looking out there. And don't tell anybody I do this, because then they won't know, you know. And I'm looking to see what's doing on the hallway. Meanwhile, they're having like a little bit of free time in the class. And I was looking, and from that, you can see a reflection of what's going on, because it's darker in the hallway than the class. So I'm watching a reflected image of what's going on. And I'm seeing in the reflected image that Avi gets somebody like professional wrestling in a hole over there, you know, and he's like working the guy over, and he's finishing him, you know. And I turned around from that, and I turned like this, and I said, "Hey, up!" And he was standing about 6 feet away from me, so I said, "What, Rabbi?" You know? And I looked back in the mirror over there, you know, and I looked back, and it wasn't happening. And the minute I turned around, I said, "That's unbelievable. I don't get it." I said, "I can't catch him. Everybody's complaining. I thought I saw it myself, but I looked so in the reflection. I didn't see it. The minute I turned, he's not there. This is really strange. I don't know what's going on." So one day I have them working privately in their seats, and I'm walking around, strolling, seeing how everybody, you know, you're doing your assignment, walking up down the aisle. He happened to park himself in the back next to some kid that came from a very, very rugged home, very, very rough home, that the whole thing was breaking apart. It was a lot of terrible stuff going on in that house. So I went to the back of the class, and he's there, and there's a knapsack in the aisle where it doesn't belong. It should be under the desk or in the seat. And it's going back and forth, and they're pushing it back and forth, like, you know, And I said, "Well, what's this doing? Whose is this? Whose knapsack is this?" And they said, "It's his." You know, each one points like the Wizard of Oz, you know, like, "It's his," you know. And I said, "Whoa." And I see there's like a 3.5 inch magazine, like, sticking out of the top of it. And I looked at him and go, "Oh, PLAY, oh boy, oh," you know. I said, "Guys, come with me." I go to the principal's office. The principal there, with his feet up on the desk, he's talking on the phone to a gvir, to a, you know, a donor, whatever, you know. And I come in with these two fellows. He says, "No, not now." And I stand in front of him. I hold up the magazine in front of him like this. "I'll call you right back." I said, "Take care of these guys, and I got to go back and manage the classroom." I come back to the classroom. I come at lunchtime. The principal comes over to me. He tells me, "Rev Label," he said, "I called up Avi's father, and he told me, number one," he says, "I'm coming right down. Number two, don't tell my wife." And in that little phrase over there, I understood something that was disturbing me for a while. And what was disturbing, and it answered the question. I understood, you know, whose magazine it was, number one. And number two, I understood why I can't catch Avi at anything. And what his, the yisod, what the foundation of his problem is. Because he learned from his prime Rebbe, not the Ten Commandments, but the 11th Commandment. And the 11th Commandment is, don't get caught. Do what you have to do. Be sneaky. Have these things around mommy. Mommy never knows. Nobody ever knows. Nobody sees what's going on. I keep it in the closet. Keep it behind the thing, you know. And then don't tell mommy. Just don't get caught. Tell a lie. Do what you have to do. But make sure you don't get caught. Be a sneak. He learned from his prime Rebbe. I could never substitute that. I could never recreate and reinstall the truth inside of him, even as a Rebbe. I can only deal with the template that his parents have given him. And I met Avi another 10 years later at some kind of a, you know, a place where kids can hang out or not getting along in life, because the whole foundation is built crooked. The building can't go up so high. He can't make a life for himself, and he can't find himself, because there's no truth, there's no trust, there's no honesty within his system over here. Be as I am, and do as I do. And then we have the positive side, the flip side, the corollary. I remember one of my rebbeim, he told us he was coming home on Simchas Torah, and he was singing a beautiful song. There's a beautiful song that was composed by Reb Chaim Volozhin, the famous student of the Vilna Gaon. The week of Simchas Torah, the day of Simchas Torah, where the Vilna Gaon had passed away that week on Sukkot time. And the students in the yeshiva, their feet were nailed to the floor. They were so down and so depressed that the Vilna Gaon had passed on to the next world that they couldn't dance Simchas Torah. And Reb Chaim Volozhin taught them the following song that says, "Olam Haba is a good zach." Maybe you've heard it. Learning Torah is a better zach. Learning Torah is a better thing. Varfavech yeder yach, let go of other things. Learning Torah, nach anach, learning Torah is a besser zach. So this Rebbe was going home with his little children, and he's skipping and singing home with them. Olam haba is a guta zach. Learning Torah is a besser zach. Varfavech yeder yach, learning Torah, nach anach.
You know, learning Torah is a better tzak. So he's going, singing with him, and the song is about Olam Haba is a good tzak. His little four-year-old daughter stops him in mid-stride, in mid-song, and says, Abba, what's Olam Haba? What's the next world? Stunned, he's got to answer his daughter. What do I say to her? You know, I'm going to start to explain from a mystical vantage point of what it is. He figures I better answer her according to her understanding, according to her level. So he's going to ask, he says, what's the most delicious thing in the whole world? If she's going to say marshmallows, he's going to say it's marshmallows all the way. If she's going to say chocolate chips, he says it's chocolate chips sprinkled all over the place. Whatever she's going to say, she says it's something that I didn't really experience yet. He says, what's that? She says, davening. Davening? Davening is the most special thing in the whole world. And he doesn't even know what to say. He came home to ask his wife. He said, Did you hear what Shandy said? She's a mom in Yerushalayim with a bunch of kids now herself. I saw her in the streets and her son bumped into her. A young Rebbetzin she is now. So she said, what did you think of this idea of davening? So he discussed it with his wife and he sat down in front of the class and he told us, he said, where did you get this idea? She said, because they didn't send their children right away at four out the door. You know, she kept them at home. The other kids went off to school. So you can imagine what it looks like in the morning. You know, this one is getting his knapsack ready, and this one gets his lunch, and everything's in. The kids are out the door, and until all the kids are out, so then now the mother can relax. And she sits down, she shares a little breakfast, and maybe a donut or a bowl of cereal with her daughter, and have a little muffin or coffee. She has a chocolate milk and a muffin and a honey bun or something like that. And then the mother says, okay, dear, you know, now that everything's cleared, and we swept, you know, the whole area, now I'm going to turn to the wall, and I'm going to daven. And the daughter is watching her mother davening. And now the mother gets this excruciating look on her face of excruciating joy, of deliciousness, of transcendence. And the daughter's watching the mother daven as she's looking into her sitter, like she's counting, like she's eating real chocolate chips. And the daughter's thinking, you know, when we were eating that chocolate chips and we were making, you know, and eating that food before, mommy wasn't going, oh. You know, she wasn't chuckling and shaking and making these, and now she's making these looks on her face. So the daughter reasons to herself from her perspective, right? And she thinks to herself, there must be something more delicious about those little chocolate chips, those little letters over there that's in that sitter, than there is in the chocolate chips that were in my donut here today. And the daughter says, whatever it is, she says, that's what I want to experience, and that's what I want. You see what a parent can do. Be as I am, and do as I do. So if the parent sets some kind of a negative example, so the kid, it's a leadership position in that sense. And then whatever the parent does, that's what it is that the children become. And that's the good news, and that's the bad news. Remember, the Talmud quotes a pasuk from Tehillim that says, Gila Barada, rejoice with trembling. Come on, Bracha, discuss, what does it mean to be rejoicing with trembling? I remember, I didn't know what the verse meant. How can you rejoice and tremble? You fear, you're afraid, you're happy, you're afraid, happy. I remember we had a little baby. We broke for a couple of days from our learning. I came back and I said, now I know rejoice and tremble. Because I remember sitting looking at the baby and saying to myself, wow, anything I put into this child, they could become anything. And I said, wow, anything I put into this child, that's what they could become. You know, that's the good news and that's the bad news. Rejoice and trembling. Rejoice because, you know, there could be good news, and trembling because I have to somehow create the right template so I should become the right type of person that will put the right type of information and the right type of experiences into the child. That doesn't mean I have to be perfect. But when we hear bad news about our children, then sometimes we have to go back and introspect and find out something about ourselves. And sometimes when we make that change ourselves, we talk to our children in such a way that says, I'm working on it too. You know, and then that makes it easy for them to change. Not that we have to be perfect. We're never going to be perfect. But when we see the fault in our kid, it's an indicator of something sometimes very often about ourselves, and it gives us a pointer of something that we can begin to work on. That's why we're so distorted and destroyed when we find something good, or we find something, we're so happy when we find something good, and we're so destroyed when we find that there's some kind of a smidgen of something bad. We move on to the next one. The next of the Ten Commandments of parenting, the next of the Ten Commandments is? Lo Yeh. This is the other one that we heard from directly, that our sages say, we heard directly from the Almighty. And this one says, Lo yeh lecha Elohim acherim al panai. Don't have any other gods in front of me. Which is really the exhortation not to get involved with idolatry. So I'd like to explain, what does that have to do? What does idolatry have to do with the Ten Commandments? What does it have to do with parenting? Let's give a very, very practical example over here. And the sages say this. First of all, what do we need the second of the Ten Commandments for at all? Because the first commandment says, I am the Lord your God. I'm your father. You know, I'm daddy. Now you can imagine we have a commandment that says, I'm daddy. And another commandment says, don't have any other daddies. Come on, yeah. I'm your father, and you got no other father. You got no other father. So what do you need number two for? It seems to be superfluous. So the commentaries, the Or Chaim, others say that number one is the headpin for all the positive mitzvahs that we have to do. There's no positive and negative mitzvahs. It's for all the activity mitzvahs that we have to do, the action mitzvahs. Lo yeah, don't have any other gods. Idolatry has to do with, that's the headpin for all the no-nos, all the refraining mitzvahs, all the restraining things that we hold ourselves back from. So how does that answer the question? It seems to just add confusing information. Let me give a very practical parenting example like this, and we'll understand it in 2 seconds. We'll understand idolatry, we'll understand how it fits into parenting also. Okay. Kid comes home from school, boom! The door just opens up, kids come in, kid walks in, the father's sitting there, we'll even have him opening up the Talmud, is sitting open at the table, and the kid walks past him, Chaim, welcome home, Chaim, and he runs past his father. Father says, where are you going, Chaim? He says, I'm going to get the ball, and the ball, the glove, and the mitt, and the cleats, and everything, and I'll go out, I'm going to play ball with the guys. And the father says, wait, time out, Chaim. Hey, remember, last night was your aunt, Melissa's wedding, and the night before that we went and we picked up the relatives at the airport, and we had a big party, we ate in a restaurant, and we said, if you're going to come out that night, and you're going to be out last night till late, so tonight, it's early to bed, you have homework, you have an assignment that's due for tomorrow and a test, so you're going to study for the test, it's going to be bed, it's going to be early, and that was your agreement, you agreed to before, no, you cannot go out and play ball now. Oh, Dad, but me. You heard what I said. That's it. Now it's homework, and it's dinner, and it's early to bed. You heard what I said. He does the gorilla grunting routine, and he moves his feet heavily into the room, and the doors open and close. The whole house is shaking. Well, some of you are familiar with that, okay? I do that. And surprisingly, my children do it too. So now 37 and 0.2 seconds later, the same kid who was so distraught that the father told him, no, you can't play ball, goes past his father with the bat over the shoulder, with the glove and the cleats and everything, and the ball in his hand. Throws it. See you later, Dad! And he's going out the door. His father goes, oh, chutzpah, that's a chutzpah. Yeah, I just told him no, and he's now going back to me. And the kid's got a big smile on his face. He says, where are you going? What did the kid say? He says, I asked Mommy, and Mommy said it was all right! So now we understand something. When the Torah says don't do something, the Torah says do something, so my father tells me to take out the garbage, I gotta take out the garbage. My father tells me to put on them black boxes to take my blood pressure, I take the blood pressure. That's what I do. But now my father comes along and tells me, don't do that thing. Now don't do that thing. But I wanna do that thing. So now I go back to my room, I'm thinking, who else can I ask? The off button doesn't go off immediately. The genius now starts to look around and see, how can I move horizontally on this field and find somebody who's going to give me permission? I'm not going to go into my face to my father. I'm not going to do the wrong thing. But I want to do the right thing. I want it. But I have to find somebody else who's going to give me permission. And that is really the concept of idolatry. Idolatry is that the person wants to go and says, listen, I've got to go find a rabbi who'll let me do this. If I can't find a rabbi, I'll make up a rabbi, I'll make myself the rabbi. I'll find a religion. I'll make a religion. I'll find a rock. I'll find a God. I'll find something who gives me permission to do these things. And the big challenge usually comes, and you look all throughout religious things, wherever idolatry comes in, it always has to do with the fear of the don't do's, Right? There's, how many mitzvahs are there? There's 613. There's 248 negative, positive things that we do, and there's 365 don't do's. Let's think about it for a second. That means in proportion, there are more things that we ought not to do to perfect ourselves than there are things that we ought to do to perfect ourselves. Let's say you're sending your kid away to camp for a year, to Eretz Yisrael, or you send him to summer camp, and the night before they leave, you have one of those little sit-downs.
Okay.
You take out the little yellow pad, and you draw a line down the middle, you fold it in half, and you say, I'm going to give you a short list of things that you ought to do. And here's a list of things that I don't want you to do, okay? Now, which list is going to be longer? And which is going to be more emphatic? Okay, I want you to call your brother, I want you to call aunt, I want you to make sure you balance your checkbook, I want you to make sure you count your money and you put it in a safe place. if I ever find out on the other side that you're doing this, or you're doing this, or any of this, or any of this, or any of this, or the boy side of the lake, or anything, you know, I'll cut off your lips. And then suddenly we list punishments. We list, you know, suddenly because if you do this, you can ruin everything. You can undo yourself. So I want to make sure that I'm as firm as possible. Well, what's the second of the Ten Commandments of parenting? The second of the Ten Commandments of parenting is that mommy and tati have to agree to each other. They have to show a unified face. You don't find the president and the vice president, you know, stepping out and saying, I think we should go to war. And say, what a war? War is a terrible thing to do. Oh, gosh, you know, let's talk about it in the back room. You know, you can't contradict each other. You know, if my wife said it and they're coming to me, usually when they're coming to me, I say, what did your mother say? You know, if they're coming to me already, I have to find out if they do a little research. Did you ask your mother already? Because, you know, they are manipulators. You know, I'm not saying they're bad, but that's their game. They're trying to survive, you know. Mommy, can we go to the mall? Did you ask God already? Yeah. What did he say? No. So how can I say yes if he said no? Because then the kid's going to find out who's softer on this subject or not, and they're going to play one against the other. Once they see that you're fighting on it, oh, then they got you. Oh, this is good. Yeah, look at that. He called her a name. That means I'm going to the mall, you know. They love it. They got you going. You know, that means they're making they're controlling the game. So that means you go into the back room, you slug it out, you know. And then you come out and you say, we say this. So if my wife says, it's not the question, oh, you got yourself into this one, there, get yourself out of it, you know. I say what mommy says. And mommy says, I say what Abba says. Now I'm talking like a big hero over here, you know. But it's not so easy. I'm Mr. Softy at home, you know. I'm the one that, you know, I come home, it's a long day, dinner's ready, put the suitcase down, and I sit down and say, oh, dinner, you know, there it is, exactly the plate of beans and, the soft, you know, exactly the way I like it. And I'm sitting down, oh, thank you, how's your day today? Good, I'm a little tired, and so, you know, mentally draining. And I sit down, and I'm about to take the first bite and make a bracha, and all of a sudden I hear, Abba! Abba! So who is it? He's still up? Yeah, he's still up. Abba! From the crib.
Abba! I'm hungry!
I said, he's hungry. What happened? He didn't eat dinner. I told him, listen, you know, dinner is from 6 to 7. If you don't eat dinner by 7, we're cleaning up. This is not an open, you know, kitchen. We're running all night. We're not a restaurant. You know, 7 o'clock, we clean up. You didn't eat your 3-4 options that I gave you. And that's it. It's a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, or it's the noodles with the ketchup, or it's what I made, or, you know, and that's it. And we're not going to bring out filet chicks, and we're not going to bring out this. We get it. And I told him that this is what it, and he didn't want to eat it. So he didn't want to eat it. So I said, you've got a bit hungry. So, hungry? You're feeling a bit hungry? Yeah, of course he's hungry. You know? He's not going to starve to death tomorrow. He'll know that when we serve dinner, he's going to eat before 7 o'clock. He doesn't want to have that feeling in his stomach again. When I'm sitting there, I'm trying to make this first bracha. With medical terminology, you know, I'm having hyperglycemic reactions. Oh my God, my kid is having that kind of reaction tonight. How can I eat my beans and my health food over here? And I said, so if the 515 tefillahs over there, you know, I said, I can't take it anymore. I go and I take a little tzaddik out. There's no wet tear on his face. It's all crocodile tear. I sit him down on my lap, you know, and what does he want? He wants nachos. He wants, you know, he wants potato chips and soda, you know. So I'm sitting there feeding him, oh, is he cute? And I says, you know what you just taught him? You know, just taught him. You just taught him that the meaning of the word no is not no. The meaning of the word no is later. The meaning of the word no is nudge long enough and you'll get it. The meaning of the word no is, you know, keep at it, keep it up. You know, you'll get it. So you wonder why they're grinding on you and they're wearing us down. Is because we taught them the meaning of the word no. If mommy and I would stand there with unified front and say no is no. With a capital N. What a gift it is to a kid when you teach him that the meaning of the word means no. Because immediately the kid shuts off and you're giving them a gift for life. What an amazing gift. You give a kid a gift for life. That when there's something that they shouldn't be doing, that they're able to halt themselves, they're able to stop themselves in their tracks. I've seen a good Jewish kid sitting in a carriage at the, you know, those convenient shopping when you're going out to have that, what they call the impulse buying section right there. They measure the arms of kids and the arms and the eyes and the face, you know. The Mars bars are down here where the carrot sits, you know. The Inquirer magazine is up here with the picture of Lady Di and the seven-headed Elvis that's being married by a, you know, whatever it is, you know. And he's sitting there, just one more item before I go out while I'm in the cashier waiting, you know. So, and the kid grabs a Mars bar or Doritos or whatever, and it's not kosher, and he's got it in his hand, and he says, yeah, I want it, I want it, I want it. And the mother says, it's not kosher. And suddenly the fit is over. He says, oh. And he puts it back. Because it's impossible to take it. It's impossible to have it. Because no, the Torah said no, so no means no. We had a first lady way back that said, just say no to drugs. You know? And say no to drugs to a culture that doesn't know the word no. That doesn't have two parents at home to say no, to stand up to a kid and to face them down. Therefore, one of the most important things that a parent can teach their kids is
no.
No. You got it. Just don't tell me no. That's all. Okay. All right. Now, number three in the Ten Commandments, the parenting in the Ten Commandments, number three is, God says, don't take my name in vain. Now, what does that have to do with parenting? Now, we mentioned last night, and some people were shocked. I grew up in a culture, a liberal American culture, where for my friends in Scarsdale used to call their parents by their first name. You know? Boy, you know, for Freddie and Betty are just really off the tracks these days, you know? You know? So who's Freddie and Betty? Is it, well, the folks, man, the folks, you know? That's how you talk about your parents. You don't use your parents' name. You don't use your parents' name. I don't let them touch my name. They don't have to say my name. Don't call me by my name. Hey, lady, you know? I'm a lady. I'm Abba. There's a reason why decent people, normal people, call their parents mommy and daddy and Ahmed, Iba, and you know, whatever. They don't call them. Call them by their first names. You don't get in that personal to me. I'm your father. There's a professional distance over here. You understand that? I used to say to his kids, that's my name. Don't wear it out. And God says the same thing. Don't do identity theft on me. Don't take my name. Don't speak in my name. And don't use my name to me. Don't call me by, unless it's in the context of a blessing. Unless it's in the context of a verse where you're referring to me or you're referring directly to me and it's Baruch Atah Hashem, unless I give you permission to use it in a certain context. Otherwise, you don't throw God's name around. And the same thing I'm going to tell you when it comes to parenting also. This is maybe one of the most important pieces of advice that I ever got, and I didn't understand it for a long time. And this may be one of the other things besides the blessing story we mentioned that you'll walk out of here remembering of anything else. Everything else will fade and say, what was he talking about? Well, he was nice for a while, yeah. You know? But this one I remember, okay? And this one is, I remember that there was one rabbi's house I used to go to, Blan Hara. I mean, this was, you know, when I come home on Friday night after eating in his house, I said, I don't care what it takes. You know, I'll even learn Aramaic words if I can create a family like this, you know? I'll do anything. 14 kids, Bliyai and Hara, Inky, Dinky, Louie, Dewey, you know, like, you know, like sitting at the table. Communication between parents and children and singing and all, everybody. I mean, I saw this, I said, this was Mount Sinai for me. This is true. Parents are talking with children and there's no generation gap. And to me, it was just like, to me, this was unbelievable. I would go home at night on Friday nights, I would cry into my pillow. And I said, that's what I want for myself. Years went by, finally, Baruch Hashem, I met my wonderful wife. Baruch Hashem, within a year later, we had a little boy. We had a little baby boy. A couple of months after that, we had a little boy for now for a couple of months. We came up with a question, I think it was in Kashrus. You know, the spoon fell into the wrong pot and this and that. And I went and I asked the rabbi, I said, Rabbi, can I talk to you about something, this particular rabbi? And he must have assumed that I'm coming to ask him a big question or something. He says, how about, you know, after the class tonight, after davening? I said, fine. So we go down to this giant room over there. He takes us down these steps and he turns on the light. This giant room, the lights go on, and we sit down. And I ask him, well, this pot, you know, the thing, when and he says, oh, you just leave it out for 24 hours and, you know, it'll be okay. So now, you know, we're all dressed up and no place to go. We've got, you know, I've got this big rabbi over here. I ask him a question. The meeting's over in about 8 seconds, you know. So I said to him, okay, as long as I got you here, Rabbi. Now he feels that I'm winging it, you know, like I'm, you know, like, you know, he's also ready to go home. Like if that's what you have to ask, that's what, and now I said, Rabbi, now since I got you here, Rabbi, what's the most important thing to build a wonderful Jewish home, to have be a wonderful Jewish, you know, parents? He looks at me like, you know, nothing really, you know, and he picks himself up and he starts to leave. A little bit shocked, you know. Sometimes people, you know, like a brother, I'm riding on the subway in Manhattan, you know, and someone will come over and say, why did the Holocaust happen? You know? Yeah. I said, how many stops are you going? You know? have to figure out, you know, whether you want the long answer, you want the short answer, you know. What do you want from me? You know, he asked me, you know, so here I asked him, you know, he looked at his watch, he's ready to go home, it looks like I finished the meeting already, and I asked him, what's the most important thing in parenting? He says, nothing. What do you want from me? It's hour at night. So he starts to leave. So I did a thing that was very chutzpahdik on my part. Nervy. I ran ahead of him, and I stood in front of the door. He's about as big as me, too. And I blocked him at the door, and I said, Rabbi, when I got married, you gave me a list of always and nevers. Remember, there were about 30 of them, and I wrote them down, and I've tried to understand them, and it made a difference. Then we'll have to have a class about that list sometime. It's an amazing list. And he says, and now I have a little child at home. If you can just maybe share with me just something that I can bring home some principles about how to be a good parent, how to have a good, wonderful Jewish home. And so he realized that, you know, okay, I better give something here. He gives a little, quiets himself down, he takes a big breath, and I see he's flipping through the Rolodex of his mind. He's a man that knows the entire Talmud backwards and forwards. You put the pin through, he knows it all. He's a man, a genius in personal interpersonal relationships. And he's sitting there. And after a few moments, he opens up his eyes. And he says the following thing. He says, don't get personally involved. I relax. My arms go down. He's able to open up the door just enough to sneak out from behind me. I hear his footsteps going up to the main level. He goes out to the car. He starts his car. He drives off. And I'm down there saying, don't get personally involved. I come home. My wife said, I'm home a little bit late. Yeah, because we said Tain Tala Matar tonight, you know. So she said, and I said, no, I met with the rabbi, and he told me, you know, oh, you know. And I asked him the kasha. He said, we take the spoon and we put it, you know, oh, good, fine. So that's why I said, yeah, no, but I had a meeting with him while I met with him. I asked him what was the most important thing to have a wonderful Jewish family. She goes, oh, what do you say? Let's get some tea, dear. Okay, honey, yes, honey, dear, okay, good. And let's sit there. And my wife gets out a notebook. We're all ready, you know, she's ready, you know. I said, get ready, you know, you sure you're ready for this? Yeah. Oh, this is good. I like it. It's hot, huh? Sweet. Yes, dear. You know what it is? He said, yeah, don't get personally involved. What? That's what he said. He said, don't get personally involved. What are you talking about? What is he talking about? I don't understand that. We got a 2.5-month-old baby. He's the cutest little thing. He just started to gurgle and you know, and smile back. You know, he's the first grandchild in the family. We have 150 rolls of film on him already. You know? By the way, his brother, the second son, we don't have any film of him. We don't have any pictures of him. We tell him he's adopted. You know, there was no evidence that he existed as a child in our house. You know, but I mean, like everything we throw him up and everything he does, we call him Bobby. He dribbles and everything. What do you mean don't get personally involved? Is he some of the cold lit vodka? This and that. You know, maybe that's what it is. He actually shouldn't have asked the lit vodka. Should have asked the Hasidic rabbi. You know? What do we do? We don't know what to do. It didn't make any sense to us at all. We dismissed it. 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, not kids, 20 years later, there isn't a day that goes by that my wife doesn't say to me, or I don't say to her, dear, don't get personally involved. Now we begin to understand what he means. You know, there's a dispute amongst psychologists, you know, in behavioral psychology. You know, the rat touches the, you know, bar and he gets a pellet. And he says to the rat, he says, good rat, you know, you touched the right bar, you went through the maze correctly. And the rat looks up and says, good psychologist. You know, I got you trained perfectly. Who's training whom over here? There's a dispute whether children are little adults or adults are big children, you know, and there's yesh for yesh, there's this one's and those ones. But sometimes the kids are pushing our buttons, right? And they know what our buttons are. And they're pushing them. And they know which words to use. So you spend all day long chauffeuring your kid around. You take him to soccer practice. And you bring him home from soccer practice. And you wait outside for an hour in the car, you know, and you get as close to the curb as you possibly can. And then his friends get in the car and he tells you, don't sing any songs. You know? Don't talk to my friends. Just get us as close to the curb as you can, and I'll let you keep me in your will. You know, so you'll do us a favor and you'll inherit my money for me. You know, fine. And you get him a tennis racket, and you get him sneakers, and you get him cleats, and you get him candy, and you get him candy for the party tomorrow, for the trip next week, and for the summer camp, and you're going to send him to summer camp, and you're choked with money, but you're going to do it anyway. And after getting all these things for him, and shopping all day long, and catering, and chauffeuring all day long, you bring him home and you say to him, "Good night, Philip, I love you." He says, "I hate your guts. You're mean." And you come out, "He hates me. He hates me. He hates me. I did so much for him. He hates me." I mean, he hates you. Who's lying in that little captain's bed over there? Who is that? Eric Fromm? You know, is this Reb Dessler that's lying over there? He knows the meaning of the word hate. He knows the meaning of the word love. Do we know the meaning of the word hate? Do we know the meaning of the word love? Those are power words. We're sitting having an adult conversation at the Shabbos table, and we're talking about this and that. It's all above the heads of the kids. And my little Sarah, little 5-year-old, she says, you know, "And Hashem created the world. Why?" Suddenly the conversation stops. What a brilliant young lady. She wants to know why Hashem created the world. She's not looking for an essay answer to a question. She knows that the question why stops the conversation and brings her to the attention. Saying "I hate you," saying "I love you" is it's manipulation. So he gets the reaction. "Oh, I got him going in now. Oh, you know, good parent. Now I got you. Ooh, you love you, so I gotta come down here. No, I really love you. You know I love you. I'm gonna prove to you I love you. To prove any I love you." The kid is manipulating. And therefore, the parents have to be, you understand? I had a guy who came to me. He said, I told this rabbi, I said, "You have no idea how much good mileage I got out of this idea." I said, "I told it all the people, parenting, this and that." He said, "Not just true about parenting, Reb Leibel, it's true about business. It's true about husbands and wives. It's true about every relationship." He says, "Don't get personally involved." You imagine a judge sitting on, he says, "You know, I'm sorry." You know, he slams down the gavel and the people say, "Objection, I'm sorry, judge, you don't know what you're talking about. Nobody ever listened to me in my court, you know. The judge slams the gavel down and the policeman comes over, "I'm sorry, license, registration. What are you bothering? What are you bothering? You're picking on me. You know, and the judge gets all emotional. And the policeman says, "I'm sorry, I'm going to give you a ticket. Now I'm going to give you another ticket." So, you know, that's it. You have to dispense justice over here. "I'm sorry, your mother said no, your father said no, that's it, no cocoa." And the reason why the kid is "I hate you" is because he didn't get Cocoa Puffs for dinner, you know? There's the whole day of chauffeuring around. So I have to give in to him. No! I told him no. So this rabbi told me it's good for so many different things. I told it over, I was seeing a psychiatrist for a number of years. For about 10 years. He's feeling much better, by the way. We were learning together. I told him over this piece. He made it the centerpiece of his practice. I get no residuals. Nothing, you know. He's giving out index cards. "Don't get personally involved and put it on your refrigerator." You know. I have a lady came over. She had a contractor that came to the house, was knocking down everything and put up a blue tarp and disappeared. You know, and took 3/4 of the deposit. And now she can't get him on the cell phone. He's got a different cell phone. He's not reachable. And he'll call you back. And finally she reaches him. He'll call you back. He doesn't call back. She comes over to our house and she says she's pulling her shaitel out. You know? So she said, you know, she can't take it anymore. She goes, "I thought I was a nice person. I'm not a nice person. I'm going to kill him if I see him. He comes up my steps. I'm going to shoot him. I'm going to take him to the truck. I'm going to turn and drive. And I'm going to drive it off the edge of a cliff." Ah! You know? And I said, write a little index card. I handed it. I said, "Here." She goes, "What?" "Don't get personally..." I said, "You have a refrigerator. Put this on your refrigerator, you know? Don't get personally involved. I mean, sue him. Call up the Better Business Bureau. Do this, but don't let him upset your day. Do what you have to do." He says, so what are you supposed to be? A cold lip lock your whole life? No, that's not what it's about. You gotta float like a boat. I saw this rabbi also on the floor with his kids. But a boat, you know, is in the water. It touches the water. It feels the water. It moves to the water. But there's a mast of the boat, and there's a whole top deck of the boat that stays above the water. If the boat goes totally into the water over there, and it tries to emulate a submarine, it's not built to be a submarine, then it's a sunken ship. Don't get sunk by your kids. You know, be in touch with them, feel them, hug them, be on the floor with them, love them, but don't let them get to your personal insides. Don't let them get to that part of you where they're manipulating you and they're controlling you with these little watchwords over here. That's terrorism. You know what terrorists try to do? Terrorists are trying with emotions. If I stamp hard enough, and if I scream hard enough, and if I make you feel scared enough, you know, "I'm going to do this." One of my kids says, "Well, if you don't live, I'm going off the derech." You know, he's going off the, you know. go ahead. Goodbye. You know? Because, you know, I'm not going to, you know, give in to that. I'm sorry. You don't threaten me and don't manipulate me. You know? And therefore, the parent has to be sort of insulated in a certain place over here where they're down and they're in touch, but you got to float like a boat, but don't be a submarine. Number four of the Ten Commandments is Shabbat, right? Remember Shabbos. Keep the Sabbath. What does that have to do with parenting? Of course, it has a lot to do with parenting. The first says, wherever we find parents, it says the last one is going to be honor your mother and father. This tied in with Shabbos. Beautiful. He says, wherever we find Shabbos mentioned, we find parenting mentioned. Wherever we find parenting mentioned, we find Shabbos mentioned. Later on in the book of Leviticus, Vayikra, it says, ish imo va'aviv tiro, the person should have reverence for their Shabbos, tishmoro, and you should keep my Shabbos. So Hirsch says over there, what are these things bound up together? So here you have a school that was set up. You have a building. It's a house, a beautiful house. Baruch Hashem, we have a home. We have that home, that Jewish home. We have a good teacher staff. We have these parents, and they know exactly what to do, but we haven't got a schedule. Right? We did a hotel program for Pesach 1 year, and 800 people in the hotel. And we spoke about this subject. I said, can you imagine if we had all these people here and all this food, but we didn't have a schedule when the eating was taking place? Imagine there's even the Shabbaton without a schedule. When is the eating taking place? When is the learning taking place? We would never be able to sit like this. We wouldn't get 1/1,000th as much done in learning and eating, right? If we didn't have a schedule and a boundary of when this is happening and when that is happening. The average home, right? You have a family and you have these teachers and you have the home. But it's hard to press to find a time when everybody's there at the same time. This one doesn't have a practice, and this one's going out, and there's all kinds of different competing things. I grew up in such a home. That's what impressed me so much about when I first saw Shabbos, that you're in a place where there's no TV, and everybody's here. We're all trapped, whether you like it or whether you don't, you know? We're going to learn to get along with each other. And that's the beauty of it. A guy came to me, Larry, that I was learning with him for a couple of years. He was a vice president of a big company. And he's busy at work, and he came home. He has two boys at that time, David and John. I think they were like 7 and 9. And he says, you know, he asked me an honest question. He says, I got these kids. He says, and I give him great credit for asking the question. Because a lot of people just try to fluff it over, but he was really concerned. He says, I got these two boys. He says, we love them. They're nice. They're sweet. He says, I don't know anything about them, and they don't know anything about me. We have no relationship. Zero relationship. They're in my house 7, 9 years already. I come home, they go to school. Hey, Johnny, how, Dave? How you doing? How was school today? Great, Dad. You know, how was soccer practice? Great, Dad. How was football practice? Great. How was work, Dad? Okay, good. We have nothing to talk about. Hey, Biff. Hey, Johnny. Dad, can I have $5? Okay. He's an ATM machine. You know, that's all. I'm here to get to spend money. And that's it. They have no relationship, no time. He says, and I'm afraid that in another couple of years, they're going to be off to college and they're going to be out of here. And I never knew who they were. We just passed each other like ships that passed in the night. Very honest question. So I hit him with the hard news. I said, Larry, he says, excuse me, what should I do? I said, Larry, there used to be a sign in front of the Lincoln Square Synagogue, you know? And the sign said to turn Friday night into Shabbos. So you have to make this sacred appointment with your kids. Sacred appointments. And he says, but I'm not a religious guy. I said, don't even do it for religion right now. Do it because you want to spend that Friday night. And I described how it's going to look. I said, you're going to buy some delicious food. Maybe get some challahs. Why not? Your wife will light candles. That signals that everything is beginning at a certain time. That's it. I'll show you when, and I'll give you a schedule to show you when. You be home from work. You're your own boss in a certain way. You can be there. And if a problem comes up during the week, if this one lied, or this one hit, or this one got into trouble, don't have to confront them at that time. Save it for Shabbos. And then you get a story that talks about that subject, and you read about it. And he says, and get down on the floor and play with them. I said, but you know what the biggest challenge is going to be? He says, what? I said, the holy telephone. That's going to be your biggest problem. Because, you know, when the phone is going to ring, you're going to go, and you're going to go reach for the telephone. And I remember one time we had with one of our kids crawling on the floor, and we had like a little play phone, and the kid was like violently slamming the phone. I said, tell my wife, look at this kid, he's very upset with the phone. She said, no, that's not a kid's play. I said, this is a girl, you know, a guy doing, you know, kid wants to take everything, make it into a hammer. But a little girl doesn't act like that with a phone. I don't understand what. She says, no, you don't get. And I said, I think so. And what we realize is that, you know, mommy's nursing the baby. There's that beautiful bonding moment. And all of a sudden the phone rings. Okay, I'm sorry, disconnect. Okay, from over here. And you go and you answer the phone. You talk to somebody else. We have this thing called call interrupt, right? Call, that's it. That means no matter who you're talking to, The next one that's coming along has to be more interesting than the one that I'm talking to right now. I'm sorry, Mom. Someone's calling me. Mom, I gotta hang up. Let me take the next one. Hello. Oh, hi, Jim. How you doing? I keep Mom on hold for the next. Hold for the next. I'm sorry, Mom. Oh, your mommy not there anymore. Okay, I'll call back. Okay. What, you know, so what an insult. And the kid doesn't, you know, says, you know, what's this? Every time the phone rings, I disconnect from Mommy. I hate phones. So I said, you're going to be there with your kids and the phone's going to ring and that's going to be your biggest. I said, you know, so you put on the answering machine on loud. And if it's a real emergency, you're not an EMT guy. You know, you're not a hot seller. You can't, you don't know what to do. And if it's really something you need to do something about, so you do something about it. But if you don't, most of them are going to be inane messages. They're going to be people selling you stuff. So he agreed to turn on his message machine loud, and he sat there on Friday night, and I showed him in the sitter where you bend your kids, Yisimcha Lukim Kafran Jukim Anasha. He says, and after a while, he told me a couple of weeks later, he said, they're fighting over the challahs. I said, they're fighting? I said, it's working. Okay, great. You know, everything's going good. You know, it's really going now. And then a couple of months later, he says he's the envy of his friends. He says that he spends this quality time with his kids. And it went on like this for months and months and months, and he was just loving it and eating it up. He says, now I have a bonding time with it. It's just us. It's all about us. And he says, and I'm building a relationship with my kids. One afternoon, his kid comes home. He says, I got a sleepover party tonight, Mom. And I'm going to go over to my friend Jimmy's house. And the mother says, no, you can't go to Jimmy's house because tonight is Friday night and that's the time when we're all together as a family. This is what we do. And the kid says, no, but everyone's going to be there. And he says, but there's a bowling and pizza on Sunday and you go to the other part of the party over there, but no sleeping over because tonight is the time that we're all together. And she put her foot down, no. And the kid didn't go to the party. The next week, Larry comes home. Like 2 weeks later, he comes home and he says to his wife, he says, guess what, dear? And he's waving two tickets. He says, I got two tickets. His wife said, what's that? He's two tickets. He says, the Rangers are playing in the Stanley Cup. It's the seventh game, you know? hockey, you know, ooh, you know, ooh, you know. I'm in the right place over here. For that, yeah? they're not the Rangers, I'm sorry. Yeah. Canadians, okay. But you can imagine how long he's waiting, decades, for this moment over, this magic moment. You know? And he's got the tickets, and he's like, so he's pumped. He's pumped. And he says to his wife, and she's, oh, good, that's great. You know, when's the game? He says, Friday night. His wife says, oh, Friday night. Friday night, that's the time when we're all together. He says, one Friday night, I'm out. She's, I already said to Johnny, no. And if I told him no, and now you go out, so I can't say no to him anymore, and the whole thing is lost. I can never, we can't stop. And then we're going to lose this beautiful thing that we've been going with now. He says, the Rangers. This is Stanley Cup. I'm waiting my whole life. I'm a fan. I'm watching the game. I said, no, she says, I understand, but you don't understand. And if we say no to him and then you go out, then the whole thing is finished. We lost our authority over here. The Rangers. He cried. He beat his chest. You know, and his wife said, no. The next day, he went back to the office. And the Talmud says, Yesh kono lama b'shacha. Some people acquire the whole world in one moment over here. Like Sandy Koufax didn't pitch on Yom Kippur. They go forever. I'll never forget that as a kid. I was an athlete, that there was something more important than even the World Series in baseball. What a message he sent. You know, and whatever else he did, but he's got something placed in the next world. It's from that moment over there. And Larry went back, and I'm not kidding over here. He did something which was on par with Avraham Avinu. And at the Akedah of giving up his son, his only son, Kachnas, Binchas, Yechidchas, Shahaftas, Yitzchas, he took those tickets, but Yishlechas Yado, and he sent out his hand, and he gave them to somebody else at the office. And he sacrificed the tickets to the hockey game. And he got his family back instead. And 10 years later, he calls me up, and we're still in touch on a constant basis, and he says that his friends are jealous of the relationship that he has with his children, he developed with his children all over the time. He said, they're in college now, when they come home, he says, they're bigger than me, he says, they sit on my lap, and I bench them. Sacred time, how important it is to spend sacred time. We have appointments for everybody, we have calendars for everybody, the kids even have play dates. But what about a date with daddy? What about a date with friends? I tell my wife, you know, the boys need attention. The girls need attention. A friend of mine, he said his girl is riding around on the bicycle, is going out in front of the house, and the boys on bicycles are coming by, you know, and they're whispering and they're whistling at her, you know. And he says, I mean, I'm afraid that she's, you know, they're going to lure her. And I said, he says, what should I do? I said, I told her what my wife said, her father used to comb out her hair. You know, if you know that your father thinks you're pretty, like the husband has to be the boyfriend to his daughter. I said, take her by the hand and take a walk with her and tell her how beautiful she is. Comb out her hair. Make her feel loved, he says, and appreciated and validated, so that, you know, so these little punk kids are going to whistle at her, so that's going to replace, you know, the love and the feeling and the esteem that I have, that I get from my father, and the wife has to be like a girlfriend to the in a certain way. I'm not saying, you know, I'm being perverse over here, to the boys. Help me carry the package. Oh, you guys are so strong, and, you know, and I'll take you out, and we have to, you know, and you'll help me do certain things, and, you know, get them involved in a certain way that they feel that they're strong and accomplished. And that it's so important to have somebody. You go out shopping, so take one kid with you, and say, we're going shopping for Shabbos, and I'll get you this, and I'll show you what we do, and I'll show you how we do it, and what I'm selecting, and get them involved with your life. Take them, make a sacred appointment. And when that appointment is made, don't break it. Because the kid gets broken when that appointment is made. So this is something that we learn from Shabbos. We have to have a schedule, and we're going to have to schedule the kids into our lives. And my wife is sitting over here, and I'm about to rechange my schedule. Okay, when we get back, as soon as we leave here, I know, you know. Okay, take out the calendar. Here we go. You know. Okay, I gotta do it too. We all have to make a little bit more time for our kids with the cell phone off. Wow, what a thing we have! And now finally we get to number five, and we'll finish up here in a moment. And that is the fifth one is. Honor your mother and father. Now, well, that's for the kids. That's not for us, you know. Bring the kids down and we'll talk. We're preaching to the choir over here because we're the parents. But Hirsch says an amazing thing. He says, honoring your mother and father. He proves grammatically that it's not a mitzvah of the children that devolves only upon the children to the parents. He says, it's a mitzvah of the parents also. He says, to honor the institution of motherhood and fatherhood. Because it's a leadership position. Right, we have to make it easy for our children to honor us. You know, it's one thing to demand respect, but it's something else to command respect. You know, we could ask ourselves, it's very easy to criticize presidents and mayors and senators and say, you know, they could have done this and they should have done that and they did that thing wrong. So what if I was the president of a nation? What if I was the mayor of a city? I am the mayor of a city. What if I was the rabbi of the shul? I am the rabbi of a shul. Whose shul? My own shul, my own house. Whatever ideas I want to install, whatever themes I want to create, whatever things I want to put on my refrigerator, I can put it on my refrigerator. The altar from Slobodka used to say, in Slobodka, we don't do that. You know, he didn't tell people wrong, right? He tells them, in Slobodka, in our house, the lambs don't do that. The Berkowitzes, okay? The Berkowitzes feel better now, okay? The Berkowitzes, we don't do that, you know? This is how we behave. When we speak, we say it like this. And this, and we create a theme. And this is our model. And this is our theme. And this is what we go for. The difference between a leader and a follower is the difference between leadership and management is a manager's walking around picking up, you know, problems all the time. Oh, you dropped this, and oh, you forgot this, and oh, he says that, and what is it, and what does a leader think? A leader thinks, oh, this is, I have a picture of who it is that I want this person to become, and I'm going to train them for the next 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years. But what happens is we find ourselves as parents, unless we have a vision of what it is that we're doing, we find ourselves as managers just going around and picking up problems and feeling, you know, and complaining and grumbling to ourselves. What's the difference, I ask my wife when we speak about the difference between being 5 minutes ahead and 5 minutes behind? What's the difference between 5 minutes ahead and 5 minutes behind? Anybody? 10 minutes. I knew we have some mathematicians in the room over here. But it's not 10 minutes. It's the whole day. Because if you're 10 minutes behind, if you're coming to shul, so you're trying to say this word to get to the next word, to get to the next word, you're not saying this word. You're like the jackrabbit. You're moving from place to place only to catch up, but you're always behind. If you're trying to get to work and you're 10 minutes behind, and you're never where you're at, you're always trying to get to the next place, but you're never where you're at. And the same thing when we're 10 minutes behind, if the teacher is one lesson behind, so the teacher can't teach. If the teacher can get one lesson ahead, let's say we get 10 minutes ahead. What do I want to accomplish in the next 10 minutes? The kids are coming home. What do I want to accomplish the first 10 minutes? I know that they're coming home. So what's the mood I want to set? And what do I want from them for the next 10 minutes? I get 10 minutes ahead. Whew, 10 minutes ahead. It's already, we're ahead of the game. What if you get 10? What if you get 15 minutes ahead? What if you get 50 minutes ahead? What if you get 5 days ahead? What if you get 5 years ahead? What would I like my family to look like in 5 years? What would I like my family to look like in 10 years? What would I like my children to look like and our family to look like in 15 years, in 20 years, in 25 years? Mommy and Daddy, let's sit down. Let's talk about it. Because the kids are wondering, it's a leadership job. Why'd you bring us into this world? Why'd you wake up our souls? to bring us down here to what? To manage us, to win problems that you can get out of your way. Why did you bring us down? They're looking to us. Like the world looks to the Jewish people. What are you doing over here? Why did you, you know, why a world? Why a life? You know, what do you want from us? Where are you leading us? Where are you taking us? If I can get 15, if I can get 20, if I can get 50 years ahead, what do I want my children and my grandchildren? I can't manage certain details. They're going to have free choice. But where would I like to lead them? What would I like it to look like? And maybe we'll just finish up with this, like, with this story, again, a personal anecdote, and then we'll finish up. We'll close up for the night. And the idea looks like this. I remember I misunderstood something that had happened for 13 years, exactly 13 years. When our first little baby was born, Baruch Hashem, so there they had him all wrapped and stamped and drops in the eyes and everything, and he's sitting in my arms. And, you know, I always heard, read, I don't know what, that babies come out screaming and kicking and screaming, you know. And this is our first experience, and shush, still, you know, I was the only one doing the kicking and the screaming, you know. Even my wife was relatively quiet. So I'm there holding the baby in my arms, just like looking and crying, oh my God, I'm looking at this little baby. And all of a sudden, after, you know, a few minutes in the world, he goes, you know, he gives like a little, you know, a little baby whelp, a lion whelp, a gurgle, you know. And my wife, I'm usually the, you know, the emotional one, but she's on the other side of the room, and she says, ooh, she says, did you ever hear a cry like that before? And I'm thinking to myself, okay. You know, it wasn't exactly poetry or music, you know. It wasn't a nidden that I recognized, you know. So I said, okay, fine, you know, no, you know. And after a while, I processed, I realized, you know, that's probably one of those, you know, like just like New York State took a footprint, and they want to know, you know, the identity of the child, so the mother's taking like a voice print. And I said, you know, that's what happens. You know, you go out to the playground, you see all these mothers sitting around, they're all talking at the same time, okay? And they're all, you know, and suddenly somebody falls off the jungle gym, and the right mother always turns around. Have you ever noticed that? You know? You know, and it's always the right mother. Everybody else keeps talking, you know, and the right mother turns around. And it comes to the men, he comes to the show, ah, Basha, quiet! Oh, it's your kid, he's such a nice little boy, you know? You know? I thought it was my kid, you know? I don't even know, if it, oh, that is my kid. Oh, I'm sorry. You know, I don't even know who you are. Who are you? You know, I don't know. So parents always make the husbands always make the decision. So I understood it that way. That's the way it is. The father, you know, the father, the mother taking a voice print like a little duckies. You know, I've seen enough National Geographic things. Like, that's how I understood it. For 13 years, I misunderstood it. I under-understood it. 13 years later, on a Wednesday night, my son turned 13. We made a community Bar mitzvah with everybody there. He sent a little pshekel over. We all ate a lot of chicken, you know, and we danced around. The next morning, Thursday morning, he'd been practicing his bar mitzvah parsha over and over and over and over again for that Shabbos morning, the next Shabbos morning. But Thursday morning, there's a Torah reading in yeshiva, and he signed up on his own that he's going to go to yeshiva, and he's going to lane from the Torah over there. Now I'm the father. Tomorrow's his bar mitzvah. And that day, that's his day that he turned 13. He's going to lane from the Torah. So I went over to him. He signed up. This was his own thing. This was not my bar. And I said, you know, you mind if I come to yeshiva? If I'm there, he's going to get called up in Aliyah, and he's going to lean from the Torah. And he gave me that look like, okay, but just don't let anybody know that you're my father. That's all. You know? So I said, okay, fine. I'll hang out in the back a little bit, you know. So I said, okay, fine. So he got there, and it finally came the Torah reading, and he was called up, and he's laning. And I snuck up a little close until I was close enough to hear this his faint voice, you know, laning to the door. And he got called up for an Aliyah, his Aliyah. And then I said, okay, you know, I better hightail to the back, because I know he's going to look around to see where I am standing in the back, and I'm not going to be there. I'm going to be up close, and I'm doing something wrong over it, so I better start to move to the back. After the third Aliyah, and after the second blessing, suddenly I hear, Yiskadal, Yiskadal, Shemei Rabban. And I said to myself, as I'm running to the back of the shul, I said, wait, who's that saying Kaddish? Before I had a chance to answer the question, who's saying Kaddish? The whole congregation of children, everybody's saying, Yehei, Shemei, Rabba, they're all saying the answer to the Kaddish. And by the time I made it back to my position where I was, you know, wanted to be found way in the back of the shul over there, suddenly my eyes opened up like faucets, and I lost it. I'm crying, I'm heaving, I'm crying, like, I don't know what happened to me just now, you know, but everything opened up, the hole inside turned mush, and now I'm crying like a little baby underneath my talus. And I'm realizing that when I heard those words, Yehei Shmei Rabba, and I heard Yiskadal V'Yiskadash, and I didn't have the chance to answer the question before I answered the Kaddish. Who was that was saying Kaddish? That was my son that was saying Kaddish. And I said, it wasn't not just the voice that we're going to be answering, responding to instinctually for the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, 30 years, depending upon how long adolescence lasts. You know, mommy, can I have this? And mommy, can I have that? And daddy, can you give me this? But that's the voice that we're going to be responding to for the next, you know, after 120 years, when we haven't got legs and we haven't got feet in this world anymore. Someone's going to have to step up, and they're going to have to play the position. They're going to play the role that was left vacant when we left the world. And they're going to have to hand the next pair of responsible hands. They're going to have to pass it on to the next. So that's my Kaddish. That's the voice that we're going to be responding to, not just for his childhood, but that's the voice that we're going to be responding to forever. So with that in mind, so it changes the paradigm. This is somebody, I've got the next 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years to work on this person and to work on these people to make them those kind of people that are going to be able to carry on what was passed on to them, what's been passed on to us, and it should pass on until the end of history. Thank you very much for listening. I appreciate it, everybody.